Hey, you know, I was better yesterday morning.
Well, maybe we could begin this morning, and might I first of all say that Dr. Robert Peterson of Greenland has to leave this morning, and I just want to thank Dr. Peterson for his attendance here. I know we all appreciate his contribution to the proceedings, and I know I speak for all of you in extending to him our gratitude for coming here. And Dr. Peterson, would you like to say a few words before we...
Thank you. I'm sorry that I am alone who came from Greenland, but in the very cold winter we had heated political climate in Greenland that might made it difficult for other persons to join this hearing. And in Greenland, as I tried to tell about it, the so-called fundamental rights without having any definition of it. And we maintain a collective land ownership and collective ownership of renewable resources. In practice, we distinguish between full-time fishermen and hunters, half-time fishermen and hunters, and leisure fishermen and hunters.
What was the last category?
Leisure?
Leisure.
In connection with non-renewable resources, we have today a joint control and administration of them, a full control by Inuit of non-renewable resources is today politically impossible, as the home rule Greenland has economy that is dependent on support from Denmark. And a Danish Anti-Discrimination Act is of importance in connection with this question, and in this way an act that should protect the weak groups but also protect the strong groups. In Denmark there is an understanding of treating weak individuals better than strong ones in some connections, but when we speak of group rights, this understanding disappears. When we speak of special ownership right for the Greenland Inuit, it is called for racism, even though we by racism mean the situation in which a strong group prevents the weak groups in getting part in the benefits of the strong groups. But beyond this, we have no many conflicts on this question, and the lack of concrete impulses contributed to a situation where we often learn the ideas on the land ownership and the implementation of them from different other areas. I got a lot of impulses here and got a possibility to compare them with each other. I am grateful for this situation, but I am also glad of meeting a lot of new friends besides old friends, all engaged in the important question of land ownership and self-government. And I have read reports on Burgess' hearings about the Mackenzie Valley project, with a great impression of the ability of channelizing the strong argument from many different places affected by the pipeline plans. I hope that the Alaska Native Review Commission will have success in its work, and I wish you good luck in your work also this time. Thank you very much, all of you, for those useful days, and have a good day.
Thank you, Dr. Peterson, very much. We're all indebted to you for the contribution you've made to the proceedings, and we wish you a good trip. I think that brings us to the first item of business this morning, which is the presentation to be made on behalf of the Dene Nation and the Métis Association of the Northwest Territories, and Bill Erasmus, Rick Hardy, Steve Iveson, and Steve Kakfwi are going to make that presentation. And I think each will speak in turn, and then we will question them as a group afterward. Is that that's the arrangement, I think. So would you proceed then, Bill, if you're first? Bill Erasmus.
Thank you. I will make a quick or a general presentation on the historical aspect of the Dene Métis situation. I'll concentrate mostly on the mainly on who we defined as Dene, and I think Rick Hardy will spend more time discussing the Métis aspect. The Dene are hunting and gathering people who have subsisted in the Mackenzie Valley for thousands of years. They have lived in that area with an economic, a political, a social system that originated from their own being and continued to live that way of life until unmolested, until generally the turn of the last century, when the gold rush in the Yukon first began to take place, when developments of natural and non-renewable resources began to take place in the far north. What happened at that time with our people was the first signing of a formal treaty with the federal government in 1899. At that time, in the southern part of our region, some of our peoples made a formal agreement with the Crown, understanding that we still had rights to the land, we still had rights to political institutions, and that basically we were making an agreement that acknowledged the non-Dene presence and welcomed them to our part of the country within a friendship and a peace arrangement. And we continued to live that way for several years until the next major development took place. Again, development, major development, lured people to the north. This time it was in the heart of the Mackenzie Valley, the Norman Wells area where oil was struck in around 1921. And again, as part of Canadian policy, the federal government had to deal with the Indian peoples, the Dene people. And so we again formed a treaty with the federal government, this treaty being number 11. And that covered the rest of the Dene area. And allowed at that point access of non-Dene peoples formally into our traditional homeland. We continued to live our way of life, and until the Second World War around 1945, when the fur prices began to decline drastically, the federal government was forced to begin attempting to get us into communities. And the next major change in our lives took place. Families moved from the land into communities. Schools were built. The welfare system began with our people. Social assistance began to take place. Our families began to be split up, whereas the children had to stay in school. And where once we had extended families on the land as a complete unit, we began to only have the men going onto the land. And the mothers, the females, generally stayed with the children or in the communities. So it was a drastic shift in our economic order. Until the late 60s, that type of arrangement continued to exist. With the introduction of the treaties, we began to have a system of government in Canada, which is called the Band Council System. In the late 60s, when Yellowknife became the capital of the Northwest Territories and the administration of government moved to the Northwest Territories, the development of local government began to take place in our communities. The settlement council system, the hamlet system, the different terms for the different communities, began to be initiated at that time. So we had a competing element next to the band structure that was in existence since the treaties. And generally, much of the control of the legal system, the political system, the major areas that make sense to a people were out of our hands. We had very little control in education. We had very little control in running our own lives. And around the early 70s, we began to organize as political entities. A major development at that time that helped to get us organized was the famous Canadian white paper that was presented by the Trudeau government, which basically was set up to eliminate any kind of special rights that Native people had in Canada and to have them assimilate into the Canadian mainstream. At that time, as descendants of the Dene, we wanted to form one political organization. We wanted to form an organization that could represent the descendants of the Dene. But because of the policy in Canada where there are distinctions between treaty, non-status, and Métis people, the federal government would only fund the treaty people, the people entitled under the Indian Act. And consequently, we formed the Indian Brotherhood of the Northwest Territories, representing only the status people, represented by the 16 chiefs. And at that time, our major concern was to clarify the misunderstanding between the Crown and the descendants of the Dene, meaning the signing of the treaties, where the government, in their understanding, believed that we signed away and ceded any kind of interest to the land and other Aboriginal rights. We wanted to clarify that arrangement, and most of our energies were towards that end. We managed to file a caveat, which basically is proving interest in lands that proving an interest in lands that we subsisted on, and prepared our case before Justice William Morrow. At the same time, there were other very important things happening in the Canadian context, where we had in British Columbia the Calder case, where the Nisga people were presenting their grievances in a court battle. The significant thing that happened there in 1973 was that 6 out of 7 justices of the Supreme Court of Canada ruled that there was such a thing as Aboriginal rights. Prior to that, there was no such statement in Canadian history that supported the notion of Aboriginal rights. The Canadian government continued to not recognize Aboriginal rights and said that if there was such a thing, it was so vague that no one really knew what Aboriginal rights was, and that we didn't have any special interests. So the Calder case, in effect, forced the Canadian government to recognize that there were Aboriginal rights. It forced them to deal with grievances that Native people had within the country of Canada. In the same year, the federal government came up with a policy statement presented by the Minister of Indian Affairs at that time, Jean Chrétien, who claimed that the Canadian government had a legal obligation to deal with outstanding grievances, and that Aboriginal rights could be negotiated. And this is where the whole notion of land claims began. It began in 1973. In the same year, the ruling came out by Justice William Morrow that the Dene indeed have an interest in the lands that they were attempting to file a caveat over, and that the intent of the treaties were indeed a friendship arrangement, and that there was some question towards some of the signing signatures on the treaties, whereas we claim that some of the signatures were forged. And the way we could present our case was quite unique because, as I said, the treaty was in 1921. It was unique in that many of our people who were signatories at the time were still alive in 1973. They were still alive where they could produce the evidence, they could interpret what happened in 1921. So we're very fortunate, and I think it played a major role in the decision made by Justice William Morrow. So that again helped the whole process of Aboriginal rights with the Dene. At that time, when the policy statement of 1973 came out, part of the policy stated that we had to prove, as Aboriginal people, that we did have an interest. And by proving it, we had to illustrate that we do, in fact, use the land. We do, in fact, have a traditional land base. And so what we did was we organized the community so that we could have our hunters and trappers illustrate the land that they use. We attempted to get the maximum extent of traditional land use, and by getting a 30% sample of all hunters and trappers, we marked out all the lands that we have used since memory. And so it covers an area in time span from the 1890s to the 1970s. Almost 100 years of traditional land use. And since that time, we've used that as our traditional land use base, that we use as a base for negotiations. At the same time, there were other major developments taking place. We had the James Bay Agreement. We had the Alaska Claim Settlement, 1971. The Inuit Tapirs out of Canada were presenting their claim. So there were many people discussing Aboriginal rights with the federal government. By 1976, after and during the Berger inquiry, where Justice Thomas Berger traveled through the Mackenzie Valley assessing the economic social impact of a proposed pipeline, we presented a model of self-government that we felt would justify our needs in our traditional homeland. And in October 1976, we proposed the Metro model, which basically was a three-tiered type government that requested representation for the Dene, descendants of the Dene, representation for the non-Dene, and a special representation for the major areas, such as Yellowknife. And when we made the presentation, the Minister of Indian Affairs at that time, Warren Allman, accepted the proposal as a unique presentation, and was prepared to support the Dene in achieving that type of a settlement. But the Trudeau administration regarded the model as a ethnic, as a racial piece of legislation, or as a discriminatory proposal, because it separated the Dene from the non-Dene and rejected it on those terms. So we continued to attempt to negotiate, and in the end, by 1978, because of different circumstances, the federal government cut our funding, ended our funding for negotiations, with the main excuse being that the Dene and the Métis couldn't get along and present one claim. Prior to that, they had assured the Métis that they could present one claim and the Dene could present another claim. Later they said, no, you can't do that anymore, you have to present one. And when we couldn't arrive at a quick solution, they said, we'll cut off your funding until you can get together, because it's a waste of time. So the cutoff of funding continued until about 1980. But in the meantime, they presented another policy in 1978 that outlined a little more clearly their intentions of settlement of claims. And basically they outlined at that time that in exchange for Aboriginal rights, they would acknowledge certain benefits to the Dene people, well, to the native people who were eligible to negotiate. And the major difference in that policy at that time was that the difference from 1973 was that in 1973 they were basically convinced that the Indian way of life, the native way of life, was basically a thing of the past. It was a way of life that wouldn't continue. And by 1978, you could see in their policy that they were changing that notion, that they in fact stated that it was the Indian way of life was unique and that it required protection. So there was a major shift. But it still included the idea of extinguishing Aboriginal rights in exchange for certain benefits. By 1980, funding resumed under the present minister, John Munroe, and he appointed a head negotiator, who was still the head negotiator for the federal government, David Osborne. And after he was appointed, we attempted to work within the Canadian policy and began to try and negotiate the whole idea of self-government, the idea of establishing a political arrangement in our traditional land use area. And they were not prepared to discuss political rights on a large area. They were more prepared to talk about regional political rights. In other words, at a municipal level where we could discuss band councils and more minor political arrangements. And we threw that around for I think a good year, trying to have the government bend and discuss our total political package, which included Aboriginal title and different areas of that we thought were negotiable. It turned out that the government wasn't prepared to speak about these political rights because there were non-Dene in our area, and in their view, they had to be included in the process. They were not prepared to speak with only an ethnic or a part of the population. Even though we're a majority, our population is a majority in our area. So a unique thing began to develop where we agreed to discuss political rights at a separate forum. We agreed to negotiate land rights, economic rights, social rights, and so on at the negotiating table, and discuss political rights at a separate table, which ended up to be called the Western Constitutional Forum. A similar forum is set up for the Eastern Arctic, which our friends from the Eastern Arctic will discuss later, I suppose. But in effect, what happened was our negotiating position on Aboriginal rights was moved to another table. So that's the forum that we've been using to negotiate. At our negotiating table, we have been concentrating on land and resources. We've concentrated on exactly who is eligible for a claim. And we've done some work in other areas. We're at the beginning stages compared to the Yukon, the Cope settlement, and most likely with the Inuit people in the Eastern Arctic. As the Yukon people mentioned yesterday, they have an agreement in principle signed, whereas we're still at the stage where we're negotiating some of the fundamental issues. In some ways, we're fortunate because we have the Alaska Claim Settlement, we have the Cope Settlement, James Bay Settlement, Yukon Settlement as examples. And we can see where they began and what they've ended up with. And at the same time, it's unfortunate that we can't sit down with the government and negotiate a total package at one time, because there are major developments going on. We have the Foothills pipeline that is being built right now from Norman Wells to Zama, Alberta. And some of our people have compared it to having a gun at our heads as we're negotiating. Because in one breath we're saying we own the resources, the non-renewable resources, while on the other hand they're being extracted out of the territories. So it's a very sensitive issue. I'll end with that, and if there are questions, and what we want to do is to finish as a package presenting our position. Then at the end we'll address the questions.
Right, I think that's a good idea. Well, Rick Hardy, would you pick up the story from there?
Okay, I'll be going back a ways coming to the same point where Bill has left off, then perhaps before I get started, I'd just briefly like to provide you with some of my own personal background. I think it's important that you understand that although I'm here as legal counsel to the Métis Association of the Northwest Territories, I want you to understand that I am Métis myself. I'm not an outside lawyer that's come in to work for them. In fact, I'm one of these persons that Mr. Justice Berger referred to as distinctly Métis in his Mackenzie Valley Pipeline Inquiry Report. I was born and raised in a small community of about 250 people called Fort Norman. It's about halfway down the Mackenzie River. And I spent all my early years in the north, and in fact, I was telling someone at breakfast this morning that the first neon sign I ever seen was in another small community in Fort Smith when I was 18 years old. And so that gives you some indication as to what has created some of my thinking, and understand that some of the things that I'm talking about I view from a legal perspective, but also from a deeply personal, emotional perspective as well. And the whole issue of the Métis people tends to be confused and emotional, and has been a cause for concern for a number of years in Canada. And so what I want to do is perhaps begin with some perspective from a national viewpoint, from the Canadian experience as to the development of the Métis as a people and the legislative treatment of the Métis people by the Canadian government. Now, it's my understanding, and I could be wrong on this, but I think that the development and the treatment of the Métis people is probably unique to the Canadian situation. I don't know of any other situation in the world where people of mixed blood have been treated differently from the other Aboriginal people. You know, the Métis generally arise out of a result of union between European men and, in our situation in the Northwest Territories, Dene women. And as a result of this union, the Métis have developed as a distinct entity within Canada. The area, the physical area of the development of the Métis Nation is probably restricted to northwestern Canada, and say western Ontario and the provinces of Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta, northeastern British Columbia, and the Mackenzie River District of the Northwest Territories. And that is viewed by a new organization that came into existence recently called the Métis National Council. They refer to that area of Canada as the Métis homeland. Now, our organization, the Métis Association of the Northwest Territories, is not at this time formally affiliated with the Métis National Council, but our people do feel some strong ties with the Métis people who live in the provinces. In regard to the question of self-determination of Aboriginal people, I think I would refer the Commission to the Métis National Council. They have been developing positions recently that call for the development of Métis self-government based on a Métis land base. And I cannot talk on their behalf because our organization is not yet affiliated with them, but I think that they may have some materials that may be of some assistance to the Commission. You know, Bill Erasmus talked about the treaty-making process in the Northwest Territories, Treaties 8 and Treaty 11. And what I would like to talk about now is how the Canadian government treated the Métis people during that treaty-making process. As I've mentioned, the Canadian government has had special legislative treatment for the Métis people, which started in 1870 with the Manitoba Act. The Manitoba Act was the federal legislation that brought the province of Manitoba into existence, and within that act there were special provisions for the creation of Métis lands. And I suspect that this was probably a result of the fact that, that the Métis actually were involved in an armed rebellion against Canada. The Métis people in 1870 had evolved to a state that they had declared their own nation in existence and had taken up arms in protection of their nation. And as a result of this, the province of Manitoba was created as part of Canada, and there were special provisions made for the Métis people in the Manitoba Act. 1870, yes. And following the Manitoba Act, as expansion moved westward in Canada, the government of Canada initiated the treaty-making process with the Indians of Western Canada, and in conjunction with that, they created what were called half-breed commissions. I won't get into the details of it, but I would say that generally they followed the model of the Manitoba Act and created an ability for Métis people to acquire land, and this was done pursuant to the Dominion Lands Act. And each treaty was accompanied by what we would call a half-breed commission. And as the years went by, the method of recognizing the Métis land rights gradually changed. When the treaty-making process reached the Northwest Territories, first of all with Treaty 8 in 1899, that treaty was accompanied by the Athabasca District Half-Breed Commission. And as the treaty party proceeded to enter into treaty with the various Indian bands, they offered individual Métis families, I believe, and I stand to be corrected probably by Douglas Sanders, he's probably got more historical background than I do have at my fingertips here, but I believe they were offered 160 acres of land or $160 in cash per person. And then when Treaty 11 came in 1921, along with that came the Mackenzie River District Half-Breed Commission. And at that time, there was no land offering to the Métis people through that half-breed commission. They were offered a straight cash settlement of $240 per person. And I think that there's an important point that I should make out here. I think we have some disagreement in Canada over the interpretation of historical facts surrounded with this situation, but it is my view that the Métis people were given a choice as to whether they could take the scrip payments or enter into the treaties. And in fact, it is my information, certainly from my own family background, my grandfather took scrip payments, but at the time they took it, certainly the government treaty commissioner and the Catholic Church bishop who accompanied the treaty parties actually did encourage the Métis people to take the terms of the treaty rather than the scrip payments. But in spite of this, many of the Métis families chose the scrip payments. And there's many reasons for this. I think we realized at the time some of the restrictions that could possibly be imposed on us by taking treaty. And to be absolutely frank about it, and you know, this is a historical matter. One of the reasons why our people did not want to take treaty, because it was their understanding that the taking of treaty would prohibit them from being able to have liquor. And as sad as that may be, that is a historical fact. The other restrictions that caused them not to take the treaties was we felt, well, certainly we did not want to live on reserves. We were quite clear on that matter. That was what the treaties made provision for, was for reserves, and we did not want to be in that situation. We wanted to have the rights of private property ownership, and we wanted to be able to exercise the franchise as other Canadian citizens in elections. And these, among other reasons, are why the Métis people did not enter into the treaties, but rather took the cash offering. Okay, now the current situation today, I would say that after the script process was finished, the Métis people were never really organized as a group. We tend to be very individualistic in nature. And after the script process was completed, life carried on as normal. We had our cash and spent it, and life went on. But then in the late 60s, we've seen other Native people beginning organizing around the issue of land claims. And so we began examining our own situation. And in 1972, we formed the Métis Association of the Northwest Territories, which was followed by the establishment of a joint working relationship with the Dene Nation in 1974. We held a